Hello everyone and welcome back to Rai Affairs. My name is Nicola and as always, I'll be your host for this episode. As you know, Rai is a youth-led international think tank that translates the abstract world of international affairs by simplifying rather than generalizing. Rai is a place where you come to learn about the stories and worries of political leaders, the behind the scenes of decision makers, and how politics impacts and changes your life. This is Rai Affairs, filling you in wherever you are. As always, I give a disclaimer that expressed opinion in this episode are welcome, even though they are not a direct reflection of Rai, as we specialize in unbiased writing. So this episode is the first in a series of six as part of the IE Rai Summer Research Program of 2025. Rai has invited 12 IE University students to join our think tank and spend 9 weeks researching a figure from around the world to try to answer a simple question. Are they a climate leader? During their research, students have done a deep dive of the person's background, policies, and the impact of said policies in an effort to bring light to the diverse ways in which every person, no matter the role that they play in society, can contribute to the global climate change policy framework. In today's episode, we will be focusing on Claudia Sheinbaum, President of Mexico. Here with us, we have Josip Biondić and Manuela Altes Alcaraz. Welcome to Rai Affairs, guys, and thank you very much for joining me today. It's a pleasure to have you here. Would you please like to introduce yourself to our audience?
Of course. Hello, everyone. My name is Manuela Altes Alcaraz, and I'm born and raised in New York, but I'm Spanish, and I'm currently studying law and international relations.
And hi, everyone. I'm Josip Biondić. I'm Croatian, and I'm currently studying international relations at IE.
Well, thank you very much for the introduction, guys. And before we start, I'll ask you to answer our usual ice-breaking question that it's basically a question that we ask every guest here on Rai Affairs. So could you please tell us which leader, either dead or alive, who has impacted the world would you want to have a conversation with and why?
I would choose Thomas Sankara, the president of Burkina Faso from 1983 to 1987. I studied him in History of International Relations for my final research paper, and I liked how he represented a bold and principled defiance of imperialism, capitalism, and patriarchy, which I consider systems that continue to dominate our world today. He did this through tangible intersectional policies, and I'd like to thank him for proving, even if for only a moment, that another form of governance was possible, one that didn't serve corporate interests or colonial legacies, but prioritized justice.
I, on the other hand, would pick Josip Broz Tito, the ex-leader of Yugoslavia. He was a very controversial leader in a very even more controversial time period, which would be an interesting choice for me just because I think the conversation would be quite intriguing. He led a communist state, some would say a version of communism light compared to other communist states at the time, but he actively chose not to associate or be completely allied with the USSR. Some saw him as a bridge between the Western and Eastern world at the time, which I find just very interesting. And he also had the responsibility of balancing clashing nationalities and identities in Yugoslavia, which he did in a very violent and in a very poor way, in my opinion. But I think with today's world, we're kind of seeing a lot of polarization, especially from these kind of different nationalities or religions or ethnicities. I think it would be a very interesting conversation to have with today's retrospective with him.
Well, thank you very much, guys. These were really interesting picks. And with that being said, I would say that we can start our conversation about the report that you wrote on Claudia Sheinbaum. And I would like to start with Claudia Sheinbaum herself, because her personal and professional trajectory has been anything but conventional. So I wanted to ask you, how do you think, but well, first, if you could give us a brief overview of her history and her upbringing, because I want to ask you, how do you think this upbringing, especially the exposure to both academic science and political activism from an early age, inform the way she sees climate leadership today? So in other words, in your view, I would like to know, how do her personal identity and scientific background shape her approach to political leadership, particularly in the environmental area?
Of course. Okay, so there's two aspects here. There's the political family identity, and there's her scientific career identity. So on the one hand, she's always expressed pride in her family's origins, her paternal grandparents exiled from Lithuania after being targeted for being Jewish and communist. And her parents were also heavily involved in politics, especially in the Movimiento Estudiantil in the 80s, which was a major student uprising at the National Autonomous University in Mexico, also known as UNAM. And it was led by student union that organized mass protests that opposed the increase in tuition and academic reforms. And she has memories of this time, even though they're blurry because she was barely six, but everything from visiting a prison where her parents' friends were detained, to hiding Karl Marx's Capital in closets, to listening in on clandestine leader meetings. I mean, this all translated into her being a very politically active student and professor herself later on, when she helped fund the student-led Revolutionary Democratic Party in 1998, despite later continuing through other organizations. And then on the other hand, well, Sheinbaum is a scientist as well as a daughter and sister of scientists. Her mother, Annie Pardo, was one of the first female biologists and professor emeritus at the UNAM in Mexico City. And her father, Carlos Sheinbaum, was a chemical engineer, and her brother a physicist. So as she says continuously, she's had science from the cradle.
Yeah, and something I would like to kind of point out is with a scientist in the political sphere is quite rare, quite unusual. I mean, even when you think about a scientist, you think about them kind of being looking at the world in a very pragmatic way, with a lot of patience, a lot of trial and error in order to get the results that they want or that they don't want, perhaps. And this kind of contrasts quite a bit with Sheinbaum's political rhetoric. There's a clear disconnect there, at least for me. She knows how to get her community involved. She knows how to get passions ignited for policies that she cares about, that she prioritizes, at least in her voting group. Some would definitely define her as a populist. And when you look at the way she communicates with her voters, there's very clear argument there. There's a lot of anti-elitism in the way she talks, a lot of people-centered conversations going on. That's also quite manichaic. So this definitely does contrast with her scientific background. But when you compare her also to perhaps other populist leaders, both historically and currently, she doesn't just say anything to get people on her side. There's usually with her messages some kind of very detailed, very precise information, at least to get to the policies that she wants to reach by the end of it. So especially when it comes to energy and environmental policy, she has displayed clearly a lot of good knowledge, a grip on information from her professional experience. So I think she's a very complex figure and with a very impressive ability to combine those two kind of very different worlds, that is the scientific world and the political world.
Well, thank you very much, guys, for this brief overview of Claudia Sheinbaum's history and basically her as a political figure. You really explained that pretty well. And now I would like to go more into the climate challenges that Mexico faces today and Sheinbaum's administration faces today. So in your report, you write that Mexico City has some of the highest air pollution levels in the world, with devastating health effects. So I would like to ask you, in what ways does air pollution expose broader structural inequalities in Mexican society? And how do you think Sheinbaum's environmental focus seeks to tackle or perhaps overlooks these underlying injustices?
Yes, well, first of all, I would like to talk about just how devastating this air pollution is, and not just Mexico City, but really the entire state. Annually, there's 33,000 premature deaths connected to air pollution, and a vast majority of this does happen in urban environments. When it comes to what is polluting the air in Mexico, the most egregious example is perhaps particulate matter, or PM. Which in many places in Mexico is the concentration of it is double the World Health Organization's limit for what's considered healthy, which is about 10 milligrams per square meter. And with the air pollution, there's a very clear socioeconomic dimension to it. When it comes to outdoor pollution, most of it is connected to exhaust fumes and industry activity. And when you look at the kind of geographic location of this activity, it's centered in mostly the peripheries of various cities in Mexico, which also kind of correlates with the general wage distribution on the poorer end around these cities. This is confirmed by various satellite images that also show the higher concentrations of particulate matter and ozone in these areas. When it comes to indoor pollution, a lot of it comes from cheaper materials that are used to fuel homes, that are used to cook, that are used to give warm temperature indoors, like the burning of coal and wood. So this also correlates with kind of economic inequality in that sense. And this is all confounded also by generally a higher difficulty for these communities to reach adequate health services when facing consequences of air pollution. So Sheinbaum, being the leader of a labor party, in this case Morena, she has a big stake in getting the votes and protecting the interests of these poor communities. And I mean, so far it's worked out. When you look at the presidential elections that she won, the voters that earn less than 10,000 pesos, Mexican pesos, 65% of them voted for Sheinbaum. So there's clearly an interest there for those communities to get her into office. And you understand why when you look at the policies that she had implemented in the past. For example, when she was the mayor of Mexico City, and with her public transport reform, which mostly affects people that don't own cars, people that live in the peripheries of cities. And these kinds of policies also don't come at an extra cost for lower classes, neither monetary costs through extra taxation nor otherwise. So this is kind of reflected in these voting patterns that we see.
Well, another problem that you identified in your report is water insecurity. And so water insecurity in Mexico is both a climate and a class issue, because it disproportionately affects the poor and rural communities. So I wanted to ask you, how does Sheinbaum's water and biodiversity policy framework reflect the challenge of managing scarce resources in a country so deeply marked by inequality and ecological fragility?
Well, just for some additional context here, I mean, Mexico is still a developing state, and it has only been a functioning democracy arguably since 2000, when the single party kind of rule of Mexico fell for the first time. Up until probably López Obrador's presidency, there was a very clear neoliberal agenda in the economics in Mexico, especially by the ex-president Salinas de Gortari. And this is reflected in the water inequality that we see today. For example, the National Water Law, which was implemented by Salinas de Gortari, it allowed the water concessions in Mexico to get as extensive as they are today. According to the Public Water Rights Registry, there's currently 550,000 water concessions in the entire state, which is dealing with water scarcity issues, which is quite telling, I believe. When you look at the water usage, 76% is used by the agricultural sector alone, and 5% by the industrial sector, which is also expected to increase by 15% by 2030 if it continues to grow as it is currently growing. Sheinbaum's policies go directly against this neoliberal sort of agenda. She has emphasized collaboration between the private and public sector to a large degree. And while she is prioritizing persuasion with the private sector, she has also made it clear that coercion will be used when necessary in order to redistribute the water resources that are currently being given out. And so far, this has gone quite smoothly. It's still very early days, but most notably, private entities such as Group Lala and Coca-Cola have both been very successful public displays of the two sectors collaborating in order to tackle the current water scarcity issue.
My next question is about Mexico's reliance on fossil fuels. Mexico remains heavily reliant on fossil fuels, and Sheinbaum's administration has continued investments in oil and gas infrastructure. How do you interpret this tension between her environmental discourse on one side and the country's economic dependencies on the other? And do you think, is it a failure of leadership, a pragmatic compromise, or something else entirely?
Yeah, I mean, is there a contradiction? Well, visibly, yes. It's undeniable that Mexico has a huge dependency, a structural dependency on fossil fuels. I mean, natural gas, which is mostly imported, remains central to the domestic energy consumption. And oil exports still form a huge part of the national economy, despite declining production. And in 2024, fossil fuels made up 75% of Mexico's energy mix, with clean energy at just 25%. So when Sheinbaum comes into play with her climate rhetoric, meeting this economic positioning, well, her as a scientist and former climate researcher always speaks forcefully almost about sustainability. However, her administration continues to fund major fossil fuel infrastructure and supports the Federal Electricity Commission's modernization of coal, diesel, and gas plants. So how should we manage this contradiction? It's more so a dilemma rooted in these systemic pressures. Energy demand is growing 25% since 2000, and Mexico still aims to cut emissions to 43.9 million tons of CO2 emissions by 2050. However, no modeled energy scenario meets this goal under high demand. So what does this make of Sheinbaum's policy? Maybe not a clear failure of leadership, but definitely a reflection of a pragmatic contradiction. Mexico revised its nationally determined contributions in 2021 and raised its 2030 reduction target from 22% to 30%, committing to an overall 50% reduction by 2050. However, their budgetary priorities still reinforce the fossil fuel systems. So even though there is arguably some progress, it's just not happening fast enough. I mean, between 2015 and 2022, wind and solar electricity generation tripled, and crude oil production dropped 40% from 2000 to 2023. But these changes still lag behind Mexico's growing energy needs and its international pledges. Historically as well, the 2013 energy reform brought private investment, but its reversal in 2018 stalled renewable expansion. And also, the grid just isn't ready. I mean, high energy prices, poor storage, and outdated infrastructure make it really hard to scale renewables, even when the will is there. So, I mean, the bottom line, there's a clear tightrope that where Sheinbaum is balancing sovereignty, development, and decarbonization. And I mean, we have to continue to observe whether Sheinbaum will lead a true transition or if these influences and systemic pressures will determine the Mexico's future energy needs.
Now I would like to move a bit more on the political level, because Sheinbaum has been repeatedly accused of being kind of a puppet, a political puppet of López Obrador, her predecessor. And you explore this in detail in the report. So I want to ask you, how does the political legacy of her predecessor and the pressures of governing a young democracy, as you outlined before, how does this shape the possibilities but also the limitations of her climate agenda? And what about the relationship with the United States, which at least to me it seems like a really important factor in the possibilities and limitations of her political moves?
Well, when it comes to López Obrador, I mean, he's been a very polarizing political figure for decades. He's been in the public view for far longer than Sheinbaum has. He's also been included in multiple failed presidential runs, one of which actually he called electoral fraud. And with the support of Sheinbaum, ironically enough, went around Mexico, declaring himself the rightful president of Mexico at the time. So whenever you kind of have these close political ties, especially with someone who does have more political experience than you do, it is not entirely surprising that people expect her to kind of work as his underling. And there also might be a bit of a gender dimension to it, but that's arguable. But either way, there is pressure on her to show independence in her policies, which will always be compared to the ones that he was implementing during his time as president. With that being said, she doesn't shy away from being connected with him. In the contrary, the fourth transformation was started by López Obrador and has been a huge part of her political agenda before inauguration and since becoming president of Mexico. And the fourth transformation is controversial all on its own. The policies that it plans to implement as far as Mexico's democracy and government is concerned portray a single-party grip on Mexico that has never been seen since 2000, since the PIR grip on Mexico fell apart. And if it continues ahead as it's currently projected to, allowed by the current majority of Morena in all facets of Mexican government, some even fear a bit of democratic backsliding to be occurring in Mexico, and it will be up to Sheinbaum to show that that will not be the case when the entire, or at least a big facet of the fourth transformation is fighting against corruption and is protecting the interests of Mexican democracy.
And then in terms of the relationship with the U.S., I mean, in terms of the states themselves, historically, the movement of sharing a border and the movement of people and resources across it has not always been easy. In terms of the current presidencies of both states, I mean, under Trump, the U.S. threatened 25% tariffs over migration and drug concerns and reinstated steel and aluminum tariffs, voicing alarm about China's influence in Mexico as well. And the consequences of this on Sheinbaum's environmental policies are that they divert resources from environmental goals, like cutting emissions and investing in clean infrastructure. So even though at first glance, Sheinbaum and Trump have nothing to do ideologically, Sheinbaum has repeatedly demonstrated to concede to his will. And this can be dangerous in the future for implementing her own policies and her own targets, especially concerning the environment.
Well, now I would like to go more in depth into like analyzing the different policies that... Actually, no, let me ask a different question, because in the report, you identify Sheinbaum's defining moment in her contribution to the 2007 IPCC report, which is the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. And I wanted to ask you, why do you believe this moment is so central to understanding her as a climate leader? And why not choosing a more conventional moment, a more conventional political milestone in her career, such as her presidency or her period as mayor of Mexico City?
Yeah, well, great question. First, we should establish what is a defining moment in climate leadership. And for us, it's a personal turning point that solidifies a leader's long-term commitment to environmental action that aligns with their values and has a sustained policy focus. This should showcase both, in Sheinbaum's case, her scientific expertise and political capability, and how that marks a lasting contribution to climate leadership and serves as a key reference in her career. So participating in the IPCC report, well, it's an unpaid, demanding commitment that reflects deep dedication to global climate action. This shapes long-term science-based policy worldwide and has a historic impact in informing, for example, the creation of the UNFCCC and the Paris Agreement.
Yeah, we also think the IPCC report stands as a landmark or a turning point in her career, especially when you compare the before and after of what she has achieved with the IPCC report in mind. There's a contrast there. Before the IPCC report, she had already her fundamental scientific accomplishments under her belt. She had her multiple doctorates, several published reports, And she had already begun her political achievements as well. At that point, she had been the Minister of Environment in Mexico City under the López Obrador administration at the time. So at that time, she had already been a domestic climate figurehead at the very least. But then when you look at after the publishing of the IPCC report in 2007, she would go on to be a founding member of Morena, the labor party that she is a part of. She would go on to become the mayor of Mexico City herself and now the president of Mexico. And she also transitioned from being a contributing author to the original report and in the 2014 version of the same mitigation of climate change report, she would become a lead author for the industry chapter with updated information newly acquired technology and advancements in science and understanding of climate change. So for those reasons, we believe the IPCC report stands out.
Well, that makes actually a lot of sense. And now that we talked about the defining moment in Sheinbaum's career, I would like to start analyzing the different policies that you actually wrote about in the report. And the first one that I would like to talk about is the public transport, the reform of the public transport system in Mexico City that was implemented under Sheinbaum. And it is often cited as a model of urban climate policy. So what aspects of that reform stand out to you as especially innovative or impactful? And now that several years have passed, what has been the impact of those reforms? Are we actually seeing measurable improvements in mobility, emissions, and social inclusion? Or has the implementation fallen short of its ambitions?
Well, one of the first really impressive things that stands out about this policy is the wide variety of the public transport methods that are being reformed by it. She didn't just pick the metro system, for example, and choose to completely revitalize it. She included the largest electric bus fleet in Latin America at the time with the reform. She also put a lot of emphasis on the cable carts that were being implemented into Mexico City, which are very underrepresented in at least the media as far as just how helpful public transport reform can be in mitigating climate change effects, but has recently become a growing favorite among environmental activists due to just the low carbon footprint of its actual production, and if implemented fully electrically, zero carbon emissions once implemented. This is also shown, which we will come to see in the presidential policies, a focus on collaboration between the private and public sector, with an example being the electric buses that she did bring. She worked closely together with the Zebra Alliance to work on cost effectiveness and technological efficiency of said electric buses.
Yeah, and I mean, I think there's a really important aspect here of, you know, how she integrates climate equity and accessibility into a unified mobility strategy. She's also been an avid endorser of cycling culture. You know, she expanded over 200 kilometers of bike lanes, scaled the brand EcoBici and the weekly Muévete en Bici program that transformed, you know, cycling into a socially inclusive, low emission option. Combining this with subsidies and bike education programs and the integrated mobility card, which, you know, may seem like a simple strategy, but linked metro, buses, cable cars, and bikes into a single payment system. I mean, this reform as a whole made sustainable transport more affordable, accessible, and interconnected. And I mean, over time, the reforms have shown measurable but mixed results as well. By 2022, the share of transport-related emissions in Mexico City fell from 39% to 34%, while annual subway ridership also increased a lot. Cycling infrastructure also contributed to an annual reduction of quite a lot of tons of CO2, and the broader system avoided also CO2 emissions. So these are significant gains in emission and mobility, and they definitely demonstrate a very effective climate solution in an urban setting.
Another policy that you analyzed is the National Water Plan 2024-2030. The plan aims to address long-standing issues of water scarcity and inequality. So in your assessment, how does this plan attempt to balance scientific expertise on one side, economic demands on the other, and finally the voices of marginalized communities? And also, how is it being received, and what early signs suggest that it might succeed or struggle in practice?
To understand the priorities of the National Water Plan, it's really fundamental to look at the four defining principles that were credited with within the plan. This includes water sovereignty, water access and justice, environmental impact mitigation, and finally, transparent management. So with water sovereignty and transparent management, these both kind of tackle the redistribution of the sources that are already available, mainly away from the private sector and back to the people, at least in theory. This is being achieved through reestablishing the necessities of the private actors, which were given perhaps more sources than needed. We find that up to 70% of water that's given to the agricultural sector, for example, is ends up being wasted, which is a shame. This is also being reaffirmed by the re-understanding of how many water sources are already in Mexico, because this does change, especially with the climate situation in Mexico and weather patterns kind of being as unpredictable as they get in recent history. Alongside with the collaboration of the federal water agency CONAGUA, which is being completely revitalized and is revitalizing also its previously non-digital but now digital platform of tracking where all the water goes to, how much of it is being used, how much of it is being wasted. So that's very important in order for the plan to come to fruition. With water access and justice, that's kind of coming in response to prior critiques of how communities that face scarcity or contamination in some instances of their sources, how they can be recuperated, because previous plans, at least, or frameworks did not allow a lot of ability for rural communities especially to get water access and justice in those instances. Finally, the climate change mitigation is already being seen with over a dozen newly planned infrastructure projects across the state, as well as revitalizing existing technologies, especially when it comes to water waste technologies, in order to continue achieving efficiency and ensuring that the floor plans that were already laid out don't go well to waste. So far, obviously, the National Water Plan has only been announced in October of last year, so it's very early days. But the infrastructure work has already begun. The new concessions platform is already available. And the National Water Law, which has enshrined access to water and environmental justice, has been put into place. So this does not go completely without controversy, especially with funding, federal funding. There's a lot of conversations being going on, especially with CONAGUA receiving a 40% budget cut, which is especially shocking considering the amount of work that's being expected from CONAGUA in terms of making the National Water Plan work. Also, when you look at the regional funding in 2025, at least, how that's being distributed, it doesn't really align with the necessities of the state or I mean, the states that need it the most, because when it comes to the water scarcity issues, the resources available in the north, for example, compared to the south, are night and day. We're talking about a complete lack of awareness as far as funding is concerned into where priority needs to be given on a regional level. So that will be interesting to see as it continues to progress.
In your report, you also mentioned the 2024-2030 energy policy. And in this sector, Sheinbaum faces kind of the dual challenge of reducing emissions while maintaining energy sovereignty. So how does her policy attempt to navigate these challenges? And do you think that she will be able to effectively shift Mexico toward renewables? Or is the fossil fuel infrastructure still too important to make space for this transition?
Yeah, well, I mean, I guess it doesn't come as a surprise that with such a complex setting in Mexico with concerning fossil fuel, that her policy is also complex, taking into account these pressures. in 2025, she made this energy reform, and the main component of this was consolidating regulatory bodies into a single national energy commission that aimed to govern fossil fuels and renewables under one coordinated framework to supposedly improve implementation and strategic coherence. There are some very beneficial parts of this policy that are strategic for renewable energies. For example, she has implemented large-scale solar initiatives that reflect a clear potential for renewable expansion. Projects like Plan Sonora in Puerto Peñasco that integrate solar power with grid investment as well. And it targets both domestic demand and has potential U.S. export. Smaller programs like Sol del Norte also make rooftop solar panels accessible to households and reflect Sheinbaum's dual commitment to climate inequity. Also, geothermal regulation reform marks a breakthrough for this underutilized clean energy. New one-stop permitting and expanded usage categories simplify the overall project development, and especially for non-electric applications. And studies are already linking geothermal investment to lower electricity costs and emissions, making it both efficient and socially beneficial. However, it's impossible to talk about this reform without mentioning this closeness that administration has to investment in fossil fuels. I mean, despite these clean energy efforts, the state backing of BIMEX, which is the state-owned oil company, and the Commission of Energy creates a structural contradiction. Constitutional reforms have classified both of these as public institutions and secured that 54% of electricity generation falls on the CFE, which is the Energy Commission, which invests heavily in refinery and cogeneration projects. And overall, this reinforces fossil fuel infrastructure and potentially slows the transition. I mean, ultimately, it's kind of disappointing to see a climate scientist such as Sheinbaum have an energy plan that, while representing a centralized state sovereignty model that continues investing in fossil fuels and some renewables, you know, have such mixed outcomes. While it may improve regulatory efficiency and prioritize national control, it also sidelines private renewables, civil society, and decentralized solutions. So, I mean, whether Mexico can fully shift toward clean energy will depend on how she balances the state control with flexibility and how these pressures from fossil fuels and renewable energies, how that speed can scale within this model.
Well, thank you very much, Manuela. And this brings us closer to the end of this episode. We almost made it, guys. I have just one last question. And my last question is about the bigger picture. So you spent 9 weeks researching one person in depth. And after all that, I would like to know, in your own words, do you believe Claudia Sheinbaum is a climate leader? And perhaps more importantly, why should the world pay attention to her right now?
Well, so this is a very difficult question to conclusively decide on, even after 9 weeks. It is clear that she has the knowledge needed to be a climate leader. She has paid her due, she has done her due diligence, and now she has a political platform that allows her to really kind of make an impact domestically and internationally. The question comes down to where her priorities lie as far as being a president of Mexico, how she will balance the different responsibilities that she has now with the environmental responsibility, including the economic priorities of Mexico, the foreign affairs priorities of Mexico. So with these responsibilities in mind, it's going to be really interesting to see how successful the policies that she's already started implementing and that she will continue implementing will be in protecting Mexico from the consequences of climate change. With what we have discussed so far, what we have seen from her past, and what we're seeing right now, we believe that she has shown enough expertise as well as political agency in order to be defined now as a climate leader.
And I think there's an important aspect here that despite her flaws and these inescapable exterior pressures, I mean, in a moment in time in which arguably inequality and climate change are the most pressing problems, especially in a country where they are as heightened as Mexico, I mean, Sheinbaum deserves to be given a chance to prove that her unique perspective and abilities can play an important role in making her a social mobility focused climate leader.
Well, great. Thank you very much, guys. And I would say that with this, we can end today's episode. Thank you very much again, Josip and Manuela, for joining me today. This has been the first in a series of 6 episodes as part of the IE Raya Summer Research Program of 2025. To our listeners, if you enjoyed this episode, make sure to check out Josip and Manuela's report at rayagroup.org and to follow us on social media to receive updates on new articles and contents. Thank you very much for listening, and I'll see you next time.